Good morning and welcome to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Liz Hoffman. Faith and Family is underwritten by our friends at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and you can check out their website and all the good things that they have to offer on our website, kfuo.org. Well, this week on the show, we're discussing something that is a part of everyone's lives, and it can easily consume all of our thoughts and our energy. We are talking about money. We're having a different expert on every day to share their ideas about the best ways to plan for college tuition, vacations, retirement, and even our beneficiaries. Now, I want to remind you that you, our listeners, get to be a part of the show. So call in or email your questions and comments for our expert. Call or email anytime during the show. Those numbers in St. Louis are 314-505-7850, or if you're outside of St. Louis, 800-730-2727. You can also email those questions or comments to family@kfuo.org. So let's get started with today's discussion. I'm really excited about our guest today. His name is Jim Dankerbring, and he's a lifelong member of Concordia Lutheran Church in Kirkwood, Missouri. Jim is also an attorney at law with Spencer Fain, Britt, and Brown. He's a member of the American Bar Association, the Missouri Bar, and the Bar Association of Metropolitan St. Louis. Jim was selected for inclusion in Missouri and Kansas Super Lawyers, and he was listed in the Best Lawyers in 2013. Jim presently serves on the board of directors for the Lutheran Foundation of St. Louis. He chairs on the board for the Lutheran Senior Services, and he is also on the board of directors for the Lutheran Indian Ministries. Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good morning, Liz. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are honored to have an expert such as yourself talking with us about securing our futures.
My pleasure.
And I understand you have an exciting afternoon.
If the weather cooperates, hopefully I'll be down watching our Cardinals bring home a victory.
Great, great. I'm sure that'll be a good afternoon for you. Well, people work their entire lives with the final goal of, number one, spending eternity in heaven. Number two, assuring that their family is instructed and taught that same word of God, so they'll also join them in heaven. And number three, that their children and their favorite charities are left with something to cherish their memory. Now, far too often, there are disputes among beneficiaries, real estate, there's misunderstood wishes that are carried out, and even family members who become enemies. Jim, would you say that the majority of problems can be prevented before a person passes away?
I really believe they can be avoided, Liz. You're absolutely correct. With the help of a good lawyer and other professional advisors, financial advisors, insurance professionals, and so forth, we have such resources at our disposal these days that a well-written last will and testament, a well-written trust agreement, powers of attorney, medical directives, all of the documents that we routinely use in a person's estate plan can really help pave the way for a seamless transition once that person either becomes disabled or upon death. And we have so many resources available to take advantage of that. I'm a firm believer that with good planning, while people are still in good health and of good mental capacity, a lot of the problems which you just highlighted can be avoided.
Now, would you say that people in general are spending enough time planning for how their assets will be handled?
Well, that's a very, very good question, and I'm always amazed at clients who will come to visit with me and how long it's been since they've updated their estate plan. Many of whom have never done an estate plan, and young and old alike. One of the biggest concerns that I have is about young people, especially when they have a child, because the moment you have a child, you need to start planning appropriately for that child's welfare. If something were to happen to mom and dad, absent a will where guardians were appointed for that child, that child and the family would be in for a costly legal proceeding in court in order to make sure that proper guardians are appointed by the court. All of that can be immediately avoided if the couple just take a few minutes, visit with a lawyer, draw up what's probably going to be a simple will, and have that child and future children properly provided for by naming guardians in that will.
And I've read that in the United States, about 55% of adults die without a will or a trust. That's a huge number of problems that need to be sorted out. Tell us some of the things that can go wrong if there is no will or no living trust.
Well, essentially, you're going to leave the family wondering how the property is going to be distributed. If there are no directions from the decedent, by law, that property is going to be distributed according to the laws of what we call intestacy under the laws of Missouri. And generally, it's a pattern that rewards the next of kin down the line. So the biggest problem is that when somebody dies without a will or a trust agreement, the property may well end up going to people that the decedent really never intended to benefit. And at the same time, the family members are now going to be faced with costly probate court proceedings in order to have an executor appointed. All of that takes time and money, all of which can easily be avoided with the use of a good will and a trust agreement.
Now, when you're helping a Christian planning a will or a living trust, what do you suggest that they consider?
You know, one of the things that we have often found very, very well received by our clients who are Christian is what we call a Christian preamble. This is not a legal document at all, but it's a wonderful message to family and loved ones, and it essentially is a statement of that person's faith and what's important to that person, faith, the love of Jesus Christ, perhaps a few verses from Scripture included, but the person, the client, really has free rein to develop this Christian preamble as a last gift to his or her family. Along with that, we typically will discuss charities. St. Louis, as you know, is a very, very strong community when it comes to charitable giving.
Absolutely.
And we've got great resources in our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod with the LCMS Foundation. You know, we've got a strong presence from Thrivent here in St. Louis. So
right.
We've got a lot of charitable organizations. We've got a great network of donors and charities. And so often the subject of church and charities comes up in those conversations as well.
Right. Now, what are the main services most people seek when they're planning their estate?
Well, certainly the primary discussion is where do you want that property to go upon your death? It could be children, it could be grandchildren, it can be charities, as we've talked about. It could be friends, friends who have cared for that person, let's say later in life. Those types of people are often remembered as well. Once we get past where the property is to go, then we take a look at what the person's estate consists of, because sometimes estate taxes can enter into the picture. Fortunately, we now have quite a large $10 million+ exemption. For husband and wife, individuals have a $5 million-plus exemption, meaning that any property left to heirs under that threshold will pass free of estate tax. So estate taxes aren't what they used to be, but they can be a concern for affluent families. So we do take a look at how estate taxes may enter into the picture. And don't forget that when you look at a person's estate, you've got to include life insurance. And we're seeing life insurance become a very, very popular tool these days with the baby boomers passing on additional wealth to their generation, to the next generation. And so life insurance, along with other accumulated assets, can often boost that person's estate beyond an estate tax exemption amount, so that estate taxes need to be factored into the equation. Beyond that, we take a look at the kinds of assets that comprise a person's estate. Oftentimes you'll have people, let's say, who are now buying property in Florida or Arizona. And without proper planning, typically through the use of a trust agreement, a lot of what we call ancillary probate, in other words, probate in outside states other than Missouri, can be avoided. So we take a look at the wishes of the client, where they want that property to go, and then we take a look at how to best efficiently structure the estate in order to get that property into the hands of those where it's intended.
Tell us a little bit about wills and trusts and why they should be one of the most important tasks that an adult has.
Sure. I would say in probably 90 to 95% of our estate planning cases that we handle these days, the use of a living trust is the fundamental vehicle. And let me just take a minute and explain how a living trust works and how it's different from a will.
Sure.
A living trust is really a legal document that's created by the client, and we call that person the trust maker. In older days, we used to refer to that person as the settlor or the grantor. The use of those words is all interchangeable, but we call this person the trust maker because he or she is making up the trust agreement. And that trust agreement is a legal document whereby the trust maker transfers title to his property into the name of the trust. And because you now have title to the property held in the name of a trust as opposed to in that person's own name, the trust dictates how that property is to be transferred upon death, and it avoids probate. So a trust really serves three stages of a person's life. While they're alive and well, oftentimes the trust maker is also the trustee. So my wife and I can set up our trust agreement, and we transfer that property into our trust, and yet she and I are also the trustees, and while we're alive, we're the beneficiaries of that. We can manage our investments, we can pay our bills, we can take care of all of our needs through the use of this trust agreement. Let's say one or both of us become incapacitated. That's what I would call phase two of what a trust agreement does. While we're incapacitated, we need somebody to take care of us. We need somebody to pay our bills, to manage our investments, to make sure that our charitable contributions are made, all of the things that we routinely did while we were alive and well. And so the trust agreement is going to specify the name of one or more successor trustees, or in this case, disability trustees,
right,
who can step in and have the automatic legal authority to take care of these things while we're incapacitated. It could be a son, it could be a daughter, it could be a trusted friend, it could also be a professional trustee, such as a local bank or a trust company. Phase three, of course, is death. And the trust agreement, much like a will, operates to appoint the trustee who will then take charge of your affairs, manage your estate, make an inventory of your estate and your assets, and then, pursuant to the terms of the trust agreement, make sure that those assets are properly distributed as the client has provided for in that trust agreement. A will only takes effect upon someone's death, and a will only governs with respect to property which is owned in that person's own name. So if I have a bank account or if I have a brokerage account in my own name and I do nothing more, when I die, that will is going to dictate where that property goes according to my directions. The unfortunate thing about a will, however, is that because I've owned that property in my own name and it's governed by a will has to be processed through a local probate court. And that in turn involves legal fees, court costs, time to appear in court, and a lot of time and expense, frankly, that can be avoided through the use of a trust agreement. So for that very purpose, we often use trust agreements as an alternative to wills in order to minimize the time and expense of a court proceeding and to get the property into the hands of the loved ones, the heirs, as quickly as possible.
Right. When would you say a will is the better decision?
A will is routinely used in conjunction with the trust agreement, and I won't get into all of the technical details there. But we still use wills in situations where, let's say, the family is somewhat dysfunctional, and the client is uncomfortable with appointing an individual as a successor trustee. Sometimes successor trustees are known to be unscrupulous with property. Let's say they're incompetent and they can't be trusted.
Right.
In that instance, you may well want a probate court to supervise the administration of the estate. Even though it may involve more time and expense, at least you have the comfort in knowing that a judge is going to oversee the process in order to make sure that your directions are properly carried out, that there are not going to be any shenanigans that are potentially the case with someone who you may not trust to serve as your successor trustee under your living trust.
Okay. And what about executors of estates? Is that appointed through wills or trusts or both?
Yeah, the executor is technically the name of the person who administers the estate under a will. under a trust agreement, that person carries out a similar function just as a successor trustee. These days, we call executors personal representatives, so you'll see that name quite a bit now in Missouri.
Okay. Okay. And what about items to be distributed? Can that be included in both a trust and a will?
Absolutely. In the trust agreement, you essentially, as I mentioned earlier, you transfer title to your assets so that they are now held in the name of your living trust, and the trust agreement dictates how those assets are to be distributed. A will does the same thing. It's okay. Just that the will has to be, the will has to go through the process of a probate.
Okay. Well, you are listening to Faith and Family here on KFUO. We're talking with Jim Dankenbring, an attorney at law as well as a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. If you have a financial legal question or comment for Jim, or maybe you'd like to share your story of your personal estate plannings, we would love to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-730-2727, or if you're in St. Louis, 314-505-7850, or email us family@kfuo.org. We'll be addressing all of those questions and comments coming up on the second half of the show. Now, Jim, I was also going to ask you about how a Christian can show their faith and their love for Christ even after they've passed away. We spoke a little bit about those, but what are some, I guess, specific ways that they can display their faith in their final wishes?
Well, certainly one of the most obvious ones is to identify your church, your favorite charities, as being recipients of your estate. Many clients continue their tithing, so to speak, with carving out 10% of their estate and having that tithe go to their church, charities, and so forth. That's very common. There are other more sophisticated techniques in order to remember charities in your church. There are trusts that we call charitable remainder trusts that are very, very tax efficient and very, very solid estate planning vehicles in order to provide not only income for your family members during their lifetime, but also what we call a remainder interest that passes on to the church or the charities of your choice. You know, we have a wonderful resource here in St. Louis with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Foundation. They have excellent gift planning counselors, lawyers who are very, very capable of meeting with clients in order to assist in structuring an estate plan that not only takes care of their family needs, but also that addresses their desires to make sure that their church and their charities are remembered. So there are a number of sophisticated tools available to include charities and your church above and beyond simply identifying them as a beneficiary in your will or your trust agreement.
And what about the young family? There's so many young families out there with children. How do they plan if something would happen to both parents?
It's a good question. Number one, the primary vehicle in that estate plan is going to be the will, because the will is the vehicle by which a young couple named the guardians for their children in the event neither of them survive. The guardians, of course, are then legally appointed by the local probate court. It's a very streamlined process, however, because obviously we want to get those guardians in the position of authority as quickly as possible. The guardians are appointed. They're entrusted with the welfare of that child from that point on. We will typically also create a trust fund either within the will or within a trust agreement so that these minor children have a fund of money for their support. The guardians can also serve as trustees of that money, or we often see guardians and trustees being different people. You may have a guardian who's not as financially savvy as you would like, but they are wonderful when it comes to raising children.
Right.
So a husband and wife client may want to team up one or two people as guardians with a bank or a trust company or another trusted individual as trustee in order to oversee the management of the fund of money that is left for these children, oftentimes life insurance. It could be their house that's eventually sold. Stocks and bonds and so forth. So you're going to have at least a fund of money to be managed by a trustee who will coordinate with the guardians for those young children in order to make sure that their needs are met.
Now, what about these guardians? Do they need to, I guess, be contacted or let known ahead of time legally and sign that they are agreeing to be a guardian?
Absolutely. It's very important for the husband and wife to make sure that the people whom they've entrusted the care of their children to know about this,
right,
that they're comfortable in serving in that position. I would even suggest that, you know, you explain your financial resources in order to make sure that there are no surprises at all if that tragic day were to ever happen. These guardians are fully aware of their responsibilities, they're accepting of it, and they're ready, willing, and able to step right in and take care of the children.
That's great, and I think the planning is definitely the key here because you just don't know. Now, what about advice? What kind of advice would you give or options that are available for the young family? Maybe they don't have a lot of money, but they do have a couple children. They want to, you know, protect them if something were to happen. Is there any options available for them?
There are. First of all, like I mentioned earlier, the moment a young couple has a child, make it a priority to see a lawyer and at least have a will drawn up. It's a very simple process. It's inexpensive, and I encourage young people who may be listening, or even grandparents or great-grandparents who may have grandchildren and great-grandchildren, they want to make sure that they're properly cared for. Tell your children or your grandchildren to make sure that they see a lawyer as early as possible to get that will drawn up and give some thought to guardians for the children. And frankly, we even suggest a backup set of guardians just in case something were to happen to the guardians who were first named to serve. One of the biggest benefits that couples can do for their children is to leave their inheritance in trust. That's a necessity while the children are minors. Okay, they don't have the legal authority to inherit money in Missouri if they're under age 18. But even beyond age 18, of course, a 19, a 20, a 21-year-old who's now faced with the need to manage his or her own money or inheritance,
right,
that's a pretty daunting task.
Definitely.
And so what we encourage families to do, husband and wife to do, is to leave that inheritance in trust for a much longer period of time. And those trust funds can continue to be managed by the guardians or the trustees who were originally appointed. You could bring in a trust company or a bank to serve as a co-trustee, especially for those estates where there's significant amounts of money involved. And the trust fund will not only allow for the management and disbursement of those monies for the benefits of the kids, but, you know, we lawyers are forced to talk about some distasteful things in life. One of them is divorce, and the other one is a lawsuit. And by the use of a trust fund for your children, you can preserve their inheritance in the event they were ever to become divorced, or if they were to ever become caught up in a lawsuit and they lost the case and they now faced a large liability, with proper planning, the inheritance inside the trust fund set up for the children could be protected from that type of liability. And you know, Liz, in this day and age, one of the things that we're seeing a lot of that I want to point out for your listeners, we're seeing a lot of people with poor automobile insurance, inadequate insurance. And we're seeing more and more lawsuits and potential liability from people who are defendants in lawsuits because of an auto accident. And so I encourage all of my clients to make sure you've got adequate auto insurance, and spend the money for a general liability umbrella policy, which is usually very inexpensive, but it provides a significant layer of protection, because without that, your personal assets are at risk in the event you're required by the court to pay money to the plaintiff.
Okay. Well, listen, we are going to go to a short break here, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion on our finances and legal issues, and we'll be right back. Remember that you can join in on this conversation if you're in St. Louis, 314-505-7850 or 800-730-2727. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Faith and Family here at KFUO. I'm Liz Hoffman, and we're discussing money management this week. We'll have a link to on our website to Jim's contact information. And so now we would like for you, our listeners, to get involved in this discussion. If you have a question about your real estate planning, your estate planning, or maybe you have a suggestion for our listeners, give us a call from St. Louis, 314-505-7850. Or outside of St. Louis, 800-730-2727. You can also email us your comments at family@kfuo.org. We did have an email come in. This is an email from Joan, and she wants to ask Jim, what happens if an organization that you left money to no longer exists when you die? Who does that gift end up going to?
That's a good question. That organization no longer exists, typically the gift might lapse and simply increase the share of the estate that goes elsewhere. On the other hand, oftentimes in our estate planning meetings with clients, we discuss that possibility with them. And so what we will typically find, at least in our estate planning documents, is a backup organization that we will specify to inherit that what we call a lapsed gift. But barring that, Liz, if the organization is no longer around, the gift will lapse and simply increase the share of the other beneficiaries.
Okay, and she also asks, can you specify within an organization how you wish that your gift is to be used?
Very much so. We call that a restricted gift. It's a gift that's going to be restricted for certain uses, for certain purposes, and we see that all the time. So, you know, one of the things that I want to emphasize about estate planning is that people need to understand that they have great freedom in how they want their property to go and how they want it to be used. I think a lot of people think that a will or a trust agreement is some legal boilerplate document where they have very little input into how it's written. That couldn't be further from the case. Clients need to understand that they have absolute freedom and control over how they want that will to be written, how they want that trust agreement to be written, if property is to go to a charity for specific uses, for specific purposes, by all means, the person has the right to have the will or the trust agreement written in order to reflect those directions.
Okay. We hear a lot about, as far as the trusts, an irrevocable or revocable. Can you maybe explain that to our listeners, what the difference is?
Sure. A revocable trust or a revocable trust, as its name implies, is one that can be amended at any time. The typical living trust that we use during one's lifetime is a revocable living trust, meaning there are going to be changes in life circumstances, there are going to be changes in one's financial circumstances that might cause you to want to amend your trust agreement periodically. So we call that a revocable a revocable living trust. It can be revoked, it can be amended, it can be changed at any time. We also use an irrevocable trust, which is one that cannot be amended. The irrevocable trust is created for people who actually want to reduce their estate for estate tax purposes. And by the use of an irrevocable trust, you are essentially gifting the property out of your estate into this irrevocable trust. And essentially, you're giving up control over that asset that you've now placed into an irrevocable trust. So we see irrevocable trusts used to hold life insurance and to hold other assets that are likely to appreciate in value, where the client wants to reduce his taxable estate, pass it on to loved ones or the next generation, and through this gift into an irrevocable trust, make that happen. The reason it has to be irrevocable is so that the person who's creating who's transferring the property into the trust truly does give up control over that property once it's gifted into the trust.
And what about making changes to a will? Is that possible?
It's very easy, and you can do what we call a codicil, which is an amendment to a will. At any time, codicils to wills are very frequent and very easy to implement. At times, when you have one, two, or three codicils in place, you may just want to start fresh and have a brand new will created. But, yeah, amendments to wills are things that are done all the time and are very simple.
And what types of changes do people make as far as maybe if one person would pass away or if there were a marriage? Tell us some of the changes that can be made.
Sure. Oftentimes, as circumstances in life change, you may want to consider a new executor, a new personal representative to fill that role. Perhaps the personal representative who you named is now dead, or perhaps that person is really not capable of managing an estate of the complexity and size that we see today. So naming a new personal representative is a common amendment to a person's will. The same with the trust agreement. Naming a new successor trustee, perhaps that named trustee is no longer available or for some reason really can't fulfill that role. That's a very common change to make.
Okay. And what about making changes as far as can you do it as often as you want?
Absolutely. You can make changes at any time and as frequently as is necessary. In this day and age of email, it's very common for us to simply receive an email from a client desiring to make a simple change to a will or a trust agreement, and we can take care of that really without any appointment necessary. The amendment itself can be very, very simple to draw up. You know, a lot of these things are much less expensive than I think most people think. Legal fees, of course, is something that nobody likes to pay, but I will guarantee you that estate planning has become so specialized and so efficient that most people can enjoy estate planning services that takes care of all their needs at really a very affordable price.
Great. Well, we do have a caller. Tina has called in with a question or comment. Tina, where are you calling from today?
Beautiful downtown Webster Groves.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. You have a question or comment?
Oh, just a comment. It's just that I grew up in a very, very large family and didn't anticipate that there would be something left to us as children or as heirs. And we did, our parents did have a trust. And it made it a whole lot easier for us alone after they'd both passed away. And we were very thankful. And we were also very thankful for the attorney who'd helped us through the process, even though we didn't call him very often and we pretty much stayed out of his hair. But notwithstanding, I just want to say that even if there's not a lot in the estate, I think it's very much worth it. And just to be judicious about how frequently one calls and et cetera.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Tina. It's nice hearing that story. And, you know, we lawyers don't often enjoy that good publicity, so I appreciate the comment about whomever served you.
Well,
thanks very much.
And unfortunately, we had to have a coup. The two that were executors initially identified, we said, you know, among the family, we said, they're just not moving fast enough, and we don't think they're capable of moving fast enough. So we had to get together and have a family meeting, mm-hmm. or at our family meeting, and said, we love you dearly, we'll continue to love you, but you know what, we really got to move on all this, and we're going to outvote you.
You know, Tina brings up a very good point, Liz, about the size of an estate. It's amazing to me that when I meet with clients, they really overlook how much they've accumulated during their lifetime. And when you factor in life insurance, perhaps a pension, annuities, real estate, we start totaling up the value of those assets. They're often shocked that they have that much.
Right. It was shocking how much we got. And anyway.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for calling, Tina. We appreciate it.
Anytime. Bye-bye.
Bye. Jim, I was also going to ask about changes if you want, say there's an issue with a certain family member, and maybe you don't want them to get any part of your estate or what you've worked hard for, can it be added in my wishes that a certain family member not get anything?
You can. It's a very, very difficult situation, but we do have families that experience dysfunction, and for whatever reason, we will see clients who wish to disinherit a child. It can create more conflict, it can create more tension, but yes, you can certainly disinherit a loved one, a child, and have that person's inheritance go elsewhere. You can also include in your estate plan, in your will or your trust agreement, something which we call a no-contest clause or an interim clause, as we lawyers call them. And essentially what that clause says is that if someone in my family or if a beneficiary of my estate contests my will or challenges the way I've written this, they're going to forfeit whatever inheritance they otherwise might have received. And those types of clauses are enforceable in Missouri and elsewhere across the United States. The concept, the idea of disinheriting a child can be a very, very difficult decision. It's something that clients and certainly attorneys don't take lightly, but it does happen.
Okay, listeners, there is still lots of time for you to call in or email your questions or comment for Jim. 314-505-7850 in St. Louis or out of St. Louis, 800-730-2727. And I believe we do have another caller here. We have John from, we don't know where he's from. John, thank you so much for joining us on KFUO.
Yes, I have a question about life insurance, if it should be placed in a revocable living trust.
It's a good question, John. Actually, what we will typically recommend to clients, and of course, you really need to have the benefit of a lawyer assist you in this, but what we would typically recommend is if it's a married couple, there's really no problem with having the spouse be the primary beneficiary of that life insurance policy. But I do recommend that with a living trust, have that living trust serve as the secondary or contingent beneficiary if for some reason the spouse predeceases you or if the spouse dies during the period of time during which the life insurance policy is being processed. That life insurance trust should be the contingent beneficiary in that instance.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Thank you so much for calling, John. Now, we were also talking about some people that there's all kinds of situations that can come up, and I just bet that you've seen all kinds of crazy things happen. Maybe give us some examples of things that can go wrong for these people who think, I don't need it, I'll just not deal with it, or I just don't have the money to put together a will or a living trust.
Well, one of my favorite stories, Liz, and this is many, many, many years ago, but I was referred an estate from a lawyer friend of mine who unfortunately had suffered a heart attack and had to retire from his practice. And this was an elderly woman who lived in South St. Louis, and she had died of Huntington's disease. And Huntington's disease, if you don't know, is something which is passed on genetically. So when I looked at the family history, you would see a reverse pyramid because, unfortunately, the family members discovered that Huntington's disease could be passed along, and so they stopped having children. So this woman died a single woman without any family whatsoever. And when we went to take a look at her apartment, she lived in a little flat down off of Arsenal, and she lived like a pauper. And lo and behold, to make a long story short, we started going through her safe deposit box and her belongings and her personal documents and so forth, and we came to find out that she was actually the legal owner of approximately 250 acres of land in South County.
Oh, wow.
Near Ringer and Forder Roads. And so that resulted in the probate estate taking title, of course, to this property. We ended up selling it to a local builder. And in fact, if you go down in South County these days, you'll see Eidecker Road and Eidecker Way, all named after the Eidecker family who had once owned this property. And I'm thinking to myself, this poor woman died probably not knowing the extent of her wealth. It was millions of dollars. And you can imagine me being the lawyer for the estate, calling distant relatives throughout the country, and even in Germany. We had to hire a genealogist in order to determine who her next of kin were because she didn't have a will. And I'm saying, you know, you're not going to believe this, but I'm going to be sending you a check for $500,000.
Wow.
So that was really one of the most interesting cases I've ever handled. But again, the sad thing is that this was a large sum of money, and it may have gone to people whom in the end, she wouldn't have wanted to have that money go to.
Right, and she may have had a special charity that
exactly.
she wanted it to go to.
Exactly, exactly.
Wow.
You know, one other comment I want to make, Liz, while we have just a minute. I think a lot of people confuse a trust agreement with some other non-probate ways of transferring property. And specifically, we have in Missouri now, we have what's called a POD, which means payable on death,
right.
or a TOD, transfer on death.
Mm-hmm.
And these are short form ways, I'll call it, of transferring property to beneficiaries without going through probate. So it's not uncommon to have a bank account or a savings account or an investment account have a designated beneficiary through the use of a POD or a TOD, so that upon that person's death, that account automatically goes to the named beneficiaries without having to go through probate. The problem with that, and the reason why I don't advocate using PODs or TODs except in limited circumstances, is because you're not really taking care of providing for that next generation. The person just inherits that money automatically. And again, I go back to my earlier examples about the possibilities of divorce or getting caught up in an unanticipated lawsuit. Those assets, once they're inherited through a POD arrangement or a TOD arrangement, are at risk. And through the proper use of planning by using a trust agreement and a trust that continues for the benefit of those children or whomever you're intending to benefit, you're really offering them much greater protection than simply the use of a POD or a TOD. So it's something that we get commonly asked about, and for that reason, we are not big fans of using that type of an arrangement.
Do you deal a lot with where there's money owed quite a bit? Say someone is in debt and they pass away. How is that handled?
When somebody passes away, of course, the estate that goes through probate is subject to claims of creditors. And in fact, you're required by law to publish notice of the filing of the will. Creditors have a 6-month period from that date in order to file claims against the estate. A trust agreement is a little bit more private, and you have the option of publicizing whether or not someone died with a trust agreement. The benefit of that is that you can get assurance that after a period of time in Missouri, 6 months, the claims are then barred against the trust or against the estate. But oftentimes, some people may choose to forego that publication and run the risk that the trust may be open to claims for a longer period of time. But what they're banking on is that hopefully by not publicizing that, the creditors won't even know about the existence of the trust. So trusts are a much more private vehicle than a will, but they are both exposed to the claims of the estate.
Okay, listeners, there's still time if you want to get in on this discussion. Maybe you have a question about your estate or your planning for the future. Give us a call. We have Jim Dankenbring. He's an attorney, and he's also a Christian Lutheran. So we're very happy to have him. Jim, I was also going to ask you, you told us about a story of that didn't have a great ending with someone that didn't have a will. What about a success story? Maybe someone who was well prepared and things just fell into place the way maybe it's intended to.
You know, boy, kind of caught me off guard with that one. There are so many that come to mind. I think some of my favorite memories and some of the reward that I enjoy about this area of practice, of course, is seeing people who truly want to give back to the Lord. They leave a significant amount to charity or to church, and yet at the same time take care of their family. I mean, after all, family, I think for most clients, is their primary focus.
Right.
But beyond family, there are so many needy beneficiaries throughout the world, and it's terrific to see a well-crafted estate plan end up leaving a significant endowment, let's say, to one of our local charities. And there are several that come to mind. But I've been fortunate to have worked with several affluent families over the years who have left significant endowments to local institutions. Those stories bring great joy. Then there's also the case where families have a bit of dysfunction, or they may have a child who is disabled. It could be mental, it could be physical, or both. And again, with a well-crafted plan it's very rewarding to see that family who have now lost their parents at least have the comfort in knowing that a well-drawn trust fund, a well-drawn trust agreement has been created in order to care for the needs of those family members, especially those who might have some disabilities or special needs. Those types of circumstances are very rewarding.
And maybe you can tell us, is there some people out there that maybe they just don't need a will or a living trust?
I would say this. Everybody needs a will. Not everybody may need a living trust, but everybody certainly needs a will, because you're going to leave this earth with something, and it can be very little. It can be a lot. And for those people who have very little, again, most lawyers who I know and who I work with try to offer an affordable product, and we structure our fees in order to help accommodate a client's ability to pay. So really, everybody needs a will. You're going to leave something, and you need to appoint somebody to administer that upon your death. You're going to have loved ones who may depend upon you. There may be charities who you'd like to support. A will is a very, very easy document to create, and so I would say everybody needs at least a will.
Okay. And I'm sure that you've had many unfortunate experiences in dealing with clients, but what would you say are some of your most rewarding experiences?
Certainly handling the estate for those families who have children or grandchildren with special needs. That's a very, very rewarding experience. And we have the ability now to create special needs trusts in order to take care of those children who have certain disabilities. We can structure these trusts in a way that coordinates with whatever federal or state aid may be available, so that they can still draw upon SSI, other federal and state aid, and yet also benefit from the special needs trust that's created in order to accommodate their needs. That's a very, very rewarding situation. I mentioned earlier significant endowments that we've seen affluent families leave to institutions or their church are wonderful experiences. Creating foundations while they're alive is also a very, very popular vehicle for affluent families to make lifetime gifts to a foundation, enjoy some tax benefits, and also benefit the charities while they're alive.
Great. And again, for a Christian to share their faith as their final wishes, what is your kind of final advice as we start to wrap things up here this morning?
There are very, very many forms of Christian preambles. We have them in our office. I know most Christian attorneys have various forms or work product which are available to take a look at. I share those with clients routinely at no charge. Most lawyers would do the same. I know the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Foundation, with their gift planning counselors, has a very extensive set of work product in that regard. But a Christian preamble is just a wonderful way to witness to your family, to your loved ones at that last moment.
Wonderful. Well, Jim, we thank you so much for joining us today on Faith and Family. I think you've given us some great advice, and I think our listeners will appreciate it as well.
Thanks, Liz. My pleasure.
All right. Now go enjoy that Cardinals game. Bring home a win.
I hope so. You bet.
Well, coming up Thursday on Faith and Family, we're going to continue our discussion on money. And we know we're to give willingly to the church, but how much is acceptable? And what about that new boat, vacation, or finished off basement? We may not need these extras, but since we work so hard, it sure would be nice to have them. Reverend Nathan Metter of St. John's Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Wisconsin, will give us a biblical perspective of how God says we should be spending our hard-earned money. So join us on Faith and Family Thursday on KFUO. We thank you again for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow here on KFUO. Remember that you, our listeners, can join in on the show at any time. If you're in St. Louis, 314-505-7850, or if you're outside of St. Louis, 800-730-2727, you can also send us an email to family@kfuo.org. Join us again tomorrow on Faith and Family. Make it a great day.